Okay, so first I have the sort of obligatory double the number of slides that I should have. So I am going to whiz through the first ones, which are primarily designed to give you a bit of background so you understand why what we did worked for us, may not work for you. I also want to make a couple of comments on Todd's keynote talk, which I found fascinating. What I'm going to talk about is pretty much sort of the antithesis of what he was suggesting we wanted to do. So instead of automating, applying a lot more people time on it. And I also wanted to say that in my 25, 30 years of HPC experience, the one thing has consistently sucked the entire time is I/O. And that's because of primarily because of the POSIX interface. But I would also comment that in those entire time period, we've had tools that would let you not use the POSIX interface. We get much better performance. And today, about three of our really hardcore code teams actually use those tools, which says something, I think, really important about the state of the art in that space. I'm going to talk a bit about some work that's been a work in progress at the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility, which is where I work, for the entire lifetime of the facility. It's about how we take the information that we get on our running system and use it to try and improve the stability of the machine. But first, a bit of background. So Argonne is home to five national user facilities. Those user facilities are funded by the US government to provide some resource. It's really too expensive or too big to be operated and stood up by a university or a single company. It's something that the US does to support the science community, which I think is great. What is leadership computing? If you haven't heard the term before, it's a very specific term that applies to resources that are much larger than you would typically see. They're run as a single system. There's an expectation that people running on that system will be doing extremely large simulations, and they're going to be pushing not only the state of the art in the computer space, the hardware, the software, the computer science space, but also pushing state of the art and innovations in the science and engineering space. So not only are we bleeding on the side of running the machine, the scientists are bleeding on the side of doing the science as well, which plays a large part in what I'm going to talk about. This is our list of current resources. We usually run a primary large compute resource, then we have a data visualization, and we have a bunch of smaller support systems. And I say smaller, but a half a petaflop, three-quarter petaflop is not really small by some concept. But our big system today is an IBM BlueJean Q. We've been running IBM BlueJeans for a long time now, all three generations. But our two large ones were the previous generation, which was BGP, and the current, which is BGQ. And this plays a part in what I'm going to talk to you about. I'll point out that it has almost 5,000 nodes, which is not a lot of nodes, but it is when it's operated as one system. And every one of those nodes has 16 cores, and every one of those cores has four hardware threads. So you can get up into the 3 billion ranks when you're running a simulation if you're running across the full machine. The other thing these systems has is a lot of memory. In this case, it's almost a petabyte, and a lot of storage, which in today's world, for a single system, 30 petabytes is not all that big, but it's kind of all we can afford. There are certain characteristics that are common for jobs running on these big leadership computing systems, and this plays a role in the work that we're doing. It actually opened up the opportunity for the work that we did. And those characteristics that are important, in the interest of time, I won't go into all of them, but I'll mention our mission is to run capability, not capacity. So our mission is not to run a whole bunch of little jobs. Our mission is to try and run as many large jobs as we possibly can. So scheduling policy then gives highest priority to those long-running jobs, those really large long-running. And this, if you look at this, boy, managing this, the top, these three images here are snapshots of the Gronk, which shows a status for our computer. In this case, it's Mira. The first one is kind of a typical running mode, which is every one of those, every one of these sets here is a midplane. It's 512 nodes. That's the smallest we let run on our system. And At the top, you've got two 16-rack jobs running, an 8-rack job, some 4-racks, and some little ones. But this is also a common scenario, which is one job running on the entire machine. As a result of that, we don't get that many jobs per day. So the kind of work that we did here can be done. And also on top of that, it means that the jobs, every job is really important. And just to give you a feel for that in terms of money, all of the allocations on our system, not all of them, but most of them, are free. So if you can get an allocation on the machine, it's free to you, and the people resources to help support you are free. You can do proprietary work. If you can get an allocation, you want to do proprietary work. In that case, it's full cost recovery. So full cost recovery means that we have to know what it costs to run the system. We have a number. It's approved by the U.S. government as a number that we can use. We get it approved every year. I can't tell you that number. I'm not supposed to talk about it. But I can tell you that if you run a 24-hour full system job on Mira, it comes in around $200,000 worth of computing. So that's pretty costly. And so you don't want a job to fail. So given that, skip that. Let's talk a little bit about the history of the ALCF. We're kind of young. We really came into being in 2007. And we started from scratch. We had a bunch of people in the research division, and we were standing up this facility. So we had a little bit of people, but we didn't have a data center, so we had to stand that up. We built a building inside of an old warehouse. It happened to be sitting next to 6 megawatts of power and some cooling that had been put in for the Star Wars program, believe it or not, and never used. So it was just sitting there rotting for 50 years. We said, we need a lot of power, we need a lot of cooling, we're gonna build it next to that. So that's what we did. And we got a contract in place with our vendor, IBM, for the system, for our first big, large production resource, which is Intrepid, was Intrepid. It's gone now. It was half a petaflop. It came in at number 3 on the top 500 list, for those of you who follow that. It was deployed in 2008. It went production. By production, I mean we have to report out on it to DOE, and DOE follows it. At that point, it's very visible. I should say DOE is the Department of Energy, in case you don't know. Parts of it went production in 2008. The rest of it went production beginning of 2009. We had all the typical challenges these first-of-their-kind, large-scale, tightly coupled systems have. There's a couple of examples. I will mention the power supplies popping was pretty amusing. You'd be standing in the data center, and you'd hear a large pop. And sometimes there was smoke. Occasionally, there was an arc flash. Not what you really want to have happening, caused lots of challenges. We ended up replacing all of those bulk power modules after they had been redesigned. So our priorities were really, get some staff to run the system and stand it up, get the data center going, get the hardware out there on the floor. Hey, we need correct answers. It needs to be running at a reasonably stable level, and we want to get the users on and do science. We weren't spending a lot of time thinking about what our sponsors might want. And our sponsors then came and said, hey, a couple of months, we're gonna do this operational assessment review thingy, and we need you to report out on all these metrics. We went, oh, okie dokie. Well, we really haven't been paying attention. We were keeping the machine up. GPFS, our global, our parallel file system would go down, and we'd know that it went down, but we didn't actually track when it went down or exactly when it came back up. But luckily, the BlueJean comes with this great centralized database where it throws tons of data into that database without you having to do anything. All kinds of really cool stuff. I love this thing when I was the sysadmin of this. It includes records for every job. It includes the parts history, so when you pulled one out, you put a new one in. It tracks all of that. It supplies tons of data, and in fact, it actually supplies way too much for one person to sit there and try and pull together these numbers from. As a result of that, it was kind of difficult for us to pull together these metrics. So we had a project that we spun up that wrote some code that would help with that. And what it did was it gathered the data, it built a list of all the system interrupts and all the job failures from it using time, time matching, string matching, some location matching, looking at, okay, I had this no-go down, that's probably what caused this job to fail. It kind of bundled all that stuff together, did some intelligent thought process on what might have caused that actual job failure, and then it wrote them all out into comma-separated value files. And then we would take those files, load them into Microsoft Excel, munge it around a little bit, and come up with results. This had some real problems with it, as you can imagine, but we got the numbers we needed. You should look at these numbers and take them with a grain of salt. There was an awful lot of hand-waving, but we did get the numbers that DOE needed us to. Things to note, this was the chart from the report. We noted 5 major outages. Those first 2, when we had an arc flash and it took out a chunk of the machine, it took a while to recover, things like that. Other things to notice is the utilization was actually not very good. And out of the 36% of the jobs that failed, only 10% of those were actually attached to system failures. We did have issues. First of all, there was all this information that we were building up and we were just doing it as a one-time shot and throwing it away, so that's not very useful. But also, the automatic system ran and it would say, okay, this is a user failure, this is a system failure, I don't know what that is. So we took all of those and we said, hey, we'll just mark those as system failures. Where we didn't have any more information, one of the things we were doing was going back to the people who were operating the machine and saying, okay, do you remember this time? It was about 6 months ago. There was these jobs that failed. Do you remember what caused that? So that's not a very good way to do it either. But we also got this nice little fault analysis table that said, this is the number of jobs that had a user failure because a task was killed with a signal sig bus. Okay, so we looked at the issues with that, and we said, okay, what's the next thing we could do to improve this? And we added a couple of things that are now core to this whole process that we have developed. The first is we put together a database that takes in all of the information from that automated analysis and stores it in some tables. It's a DB2 database because that's what the BlueJean has, and it just made it nice to work with the same infrastructure. And it builds availability event tables. That's events that happened that took part of the system down with a start and an end, and categorize it as, hey, this was a GPFS failure, this was a scheduler failure, this was a hardware problem on the compute side, that kind of stuff. And then the other was failures on the job. So it's every single job that failed, and primarily every single job that failed that was not a user marked as a user failure. And there was tools that were built that provide an interface to manage that data and annotate it after the fact. But the most important thing that happened was we added this weekly meeting where every week a chunk of people from the operations team gets together and they work through all of those failures one by one. And they would come together as a long meeting and they would do sort of a deep root cause analysis. They would look at the job, they would say, okay, we don't know why this failed. We don't know if it was user failure or system failure. Let's look at the output. Let's go look at their job log files. Let's go look at what was happening on the machine here. Let's go look at what was happening there. Can we look at some of the availability events and tie it to that job to do what a person could do that the automated code couldn't do? And that's sort of the core and the heart of this whole thing. There was some major bottlenecks in it, but that was it. This is an example of one of the reports that would come out of that system. At the top part tells you about all the failures that you had on the hardware side. This middle section tells you about all of the non-user failures, so software and other things. And then down here at the bottom, there was a list of all of the failures that happened over the time period of this report and what was the primary cause of it. So in this case, we had 13 system availability events that were the result of a scheduler failure. Okay, so what was the impact of all this work? Okay, we're now getting actually accurate OAR results, which was good, because that gave us a measure of confidence when we reported up to our sponsor. And it was much more accurate in part because we were only talking to the sysadmins and saying, okay, for the past week, what happened? So it's easier to remember that. And we took a bunch of those unknowns that before we were just throwing in the system bucket and actually were able to characterize them as actual user failures. However, the most important, interesting thing, I thought, is that the level of expertise and knowledge on the operations team actually started rising. As a result of digging into this, when you're looking at all these systems, you're analyzing a job and you're looking at the network failures that happened or what could have been happening over here in the hardware side or what could be happening with the memory or what could have been happening in GPFS in the failure file system space. You start really getting a good grasp of the complexity of the system and how there's dependencies across them and how they correlate with each other. And the other thing that happened was we could take that component failure list and some other information and we can say, as usual, we were short-staffed. We're always short-staffed. And we had to focus our attentions when we were really needing to solve a problem on the most critical problems. And so we could start using that and saying, hey, half of the system failures that we had over this time period were GPFS. We need to go spend a lot of time trying to understand what the real failure is and fix it. We also, at that same time, around that same time, started implementing a similar situation on the scheduling. And I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but here's just an example of some of the stats that were pulled. And then the scheduling team, which was cross-facility, not just operations, were able to start digging into things and make major improvements in the usability and utilization of the system. So here's some examples of where this played out successfully. One is our system, the BlueJean, has the ability to electrically isolate every job on the network side. And that means that you can get fantastic scaling on the machine because there's no conflicts or collisions on the network except for with yourself. That's great, and the way they do it is every time you run a job, you boot all of the nodes involved in the job, you put a clean OS down, and you train the networking links to just involve your traffic, which is great, except when every, you know, intermittently, a large portion of those boots fail. So after doing this for a while, we noticed that a large part of the problems, the system failures, were the result of this boot failing. So a team got together, they did a bunch of digging. They ended up figuring out the problem was primarily related to two things: the performance of the database, the centralized database that BlueJean used to execute and load the executables and so forth, but also the fact that the server that serves up the root mount for all the nodes that were being booted was on the same system as, albeit a very beefy IBM server, and so there was performance issues with that, and it just was failing intermittently to get all of the NFS boots completed. They went and they purchased a new NFS system, they reconfigured the database, we got all kinds of major wins out of a result of this, but all of those boot failures went away completely. So that was a place where that deep analysis really helped. Another one was similar, it was the GPFS thing I mentioned. We were having terrible problems, but it wasn't really clear it was GPFS that was causing this instability across the machine until we were looking at the root cause analysis and saying, hey, GPFS is the top contender by a large part. They went in, they dug into it, they figured out where they needed to do. It was very complex. It involved network issues, GPFS issues, and the service node configuration. Any one of those might not have been a problem on a system that wasn't pushed as hard as ours was, but all three of those combined was what was causing the problem. They fixed it. The GPFS problems went down to a much more reasonable thing. Our failures were cut in half. Our mean time to failure went way up. So it was great. Another one was this, which is really interesting because as you're looking at all these jobs, you get to see what users do that is really stupid, that causes all kinds of problems across the system, not just with their jobs. In this case, one user's automated job submission script was actually causing I/O failures that was breaking jobs across the machine. And we just simply educated the user, got the script fixed, and those particular I/O failures went away. Okay, so some actual sort of numbers. In my case that I'm talking about, mean time to interrupt and mean time to failure, those are DOE's definitions, maybe not the definition that you might see out in the standard community. In the case of mean time to interrupt, it's an outage. It's the time between outages of any kind, including scheduled maintenance. And that means that limits, this is limited as to how good you can do, because we have a bi-weekly scheduled outage where we do maintenance on the machine. The mean time to failure is probably more interesting, because that's really the time between a system failure, either hardware or software. We implemented root cause analysis around here, and we did see some pretty extreme improvements. Some of that's going to come just from maturity of the software and the hardware, but a lot of that did come as a result of this process. Now, you'll also notice that we had this major drop for the last couple of years, and that was because never build a data center using 50-year-old power infrastructure. We had a transformer explode. That was really bad. And it was a transformer that was so old that we couldn't just plop a replacement one in, so it took them a long time to fix it. We had breakers go out. We had weird UPS bypass problems. It was strange. Luckily, that was no longer our data center. Okay, a little bit. Overall availability, scheduled availability, you can see that we did improve some, and we just kind of stayed up there. And utilization actually had a major improvement. On a system of this, a leadership class, one of the things you see is not a large utilization. So anything over 80% is great, because you're running these large jobs, you got the draining problem. And filling in and backfill can be challenging. Okay. So this weekly root cause analysis is really valuable. However, just think about getting together with your fellow employees for a 4 or 5 hour long meeting. It's really painful. And it was made more painful because we didn't have the right tools in place to do this in a parallel fashion. There was bottlenecks. And also, you couldn't really tell what the person next to you was doing. They could be figuring out that, hey, there was this system problem, and it caused all kinds of job failures for a long period of time that you might not have realized. You couldn't tell that they were doing that. You could have been working on some job failures that their work impacted. And so we spent some time, and we put together two new systems, two new packages underneath this. And I will say that this was timed deliberately with the delivery of our Q system, because IBM, in their infinite wisdom, decided what those RAS messages meant needed to be different. So we had the same message IDs, but they meant completely different things. So the whole infrastructure underneath had to be reworked anyway. So plus we moved into a new data center, and we had all new infrastructure, networking, and the whole bit. So we took advantage of that. We did two things. One was this Alacrify project that reworked all of the failure analysis. It modularized it, did things that you would expect to see in any big software environment, i.e. add testing. We installed Jenkins, which we use for nightly testing for a whole bunch of things. It works great. And we implemented a completely separate development release environments, which most people would say, why didn't you do that from the beginning? But anyway, so now it was there. And on top of that, we then added this Storm project. And this has grown significantly from what it was intended to be. But basically, it's a web server that when the team comes in to do their weekly meeting, they sit down, they log into it. It automatically creates a RabbitMQ message queue for each person who's logged in. And then as you make changes, you say, oh, these jobs were related to this failure, and you drag and drop and you check buttons, and it's really relatively easy to do. Everybody else's screens are automatically updated using the underlying infrastructure there. And so that works really well. And those meetings are now about an hour long. And I've been to them just to experience it, and it's really fast, and it's actually kind of fun. This has also turned into a lot of cool features. One of the things that was added, which I don't have pictures of, but would shock you if you saw it. There's a time sequence plotting of all the jobs running on the system, and it's very visual, and you can see these gaps where somebody's done something really strange with their job, where nothing's running, and or failures follow those jobs. So there's some really interesting pattern matching work there. This is an example of one of the pages, just to show you a job, the timestamp, the job ID, the username, the location. Can't you love that location? And then the information about how the job failed, as much as is known. So all it really had was an exit status of 255. And a noted that it was unknown. And then when they're working with this, they'll end up annotating it with why they thought the failure happened, connecting it to other jobs that failed, and turning that unknown to user system. Here's another example, couple actually. This is one that the automated system said, hey, I think this is related to this hardware failure over there. And so it marked it as system, and it put some information and it flagged it with red, so they knew that it was probably a system failure. Here's one where a whole bunch of jobs from this one user, Pochan, and actually that's kind of amusing. I was talking to the guy who wrote the failure analysis code, and he was telling me at one point he actually put in some code in there that said, F user Pochan, mark as user error. This is a schematic of the entire process now, which looks a lot more complicated than it is. If you have any questions about any of this, I can try and answer it. It's too much to go into right now, but there's a lot of database tables, a lot of different databases, and a lot of things that feed, and this represents actual people doing work. Okay, so I want to note that the result of this process has a huge impact on our deployment of Mira. Now, Mira is a 20% larger system node count-wise. It actually was a lot of new tech. One of the things it had that was new was water cooling instead of air cooling, and that added a bunch of more components. So it's really a lot more than 20% larger in terms of component counts. Even with that, it's actually very stable. And in fact, if you look at it, the mean time to interrupt and mean time to failure kind of started where Mira was in year two. So our first year, we were at where Mira was. By the second year, which was last year, we were already exceeding Intrepid's best mean time to failure by about 20%. And I contribute that a lot of that to this root cause analysis that is being done. The overall and scheduled availability is already over Intrepid's best at 96% and almost, 99%. I don't think we're going to actually go any higher than that because there are certain limitations, like you can't really go over 100%. But even with those multiple power outages, and I don't know what it is, but power is just a problem. This is in a different building, and we've had a Mylar balloon that fell across to the power lines and took down power to the building for a while. That was, not really our fault. And then we also had breakers blowing, breakers resetting. I don't know. I think in the power space, this is something that plagues us a lot. But even with that, we're really pretty stable. And utilization started around 80%, which is good. And now it's close to 88%. I don't think it'll get much higher than that, no matter what we do. In the future workspace, we haven't released this code, all of these codes that we have, primarily because it's very BlueJeans-centric. But our next machines, which were announced about a month ago, are coming. They're not BlueJeans systems because that Q is the last of the BlueJeans architecture line. And so that's going to require us to actually take that BlueJeans-centric stuff out and make it a lot more general. At that point, I've been talking to people about having potential for future releases. There's some more improvements we can do in the automated space, which I think is great. So anything we can do to reduce the number of jobs that people actually have to look at would be great. There's some improvements that could be made technology-wise on the storm system. So in general, summary-wise, the driver for this was not to improve the system stability. The driver was to make our sponsors happy. But in the long term, it actually improved the stability for a number of reasons that weren't obvious to us when we first started. Rather than talk about that, I want to talk about something that's really important. The work that was done, this was not done by me. It was done by the entire ops team over the past 7 years. And these are the primary ones for each of the projects. And they get a lot of credit for this. Brian Tunin and Andrew Cherry did the automated failure analysis. Then Cheetah and Brian did the OAR DB and the OAR tool. Eric Pershey and Nick Anderson, a student that we had, did the STORM project. They also did the Alacrify project, kind of did it together. But everybody who has been a part of that team has contributed significantly to this work. And that gives me 31 seconds for anybody who'd like to ask questions.
So at the start of your talk, you said this is the exact opposite of what Todd talked about. I would say it's exactly the same as what Todd talked about. If you go back one slide, that describes what we do in SRE. We do it slightly differently in that we tend to root cause on the spot rather than in a giant meeting, but this approach, this is exactly what we do in Google.
Right. I was kind of talking about, I was joking a little bit, but I was talking to some extent about the get the people out of the way and automate as much as possible kind of, and then focus the people on other kinds of work. And I know what you say, though. Good point.
Susan, thank you very much. That was really epic.